Otters didn't have any, so I gave him the uranium out of the bomb. That was part of the bargain.
What? You gave that murdering tribe of gooks that uranium?
You heard me. And if you think you could have used it better by blasting him out of that mountain, you're crazy.
Why, you abysmal, blasted imbecile. That's the only bomb we had. Those Potters could tear Penolpan off the face of the planet.
If you want that uranium, Colville, you can go out and get it. If I'm fired, I'm through now.
Why, you fresh mutt, you yellow-livered louse. I ought
to
kill you.
If you asked me, I'd say it'd be dangerous business trying to get that uranium back now.
We're a check.
Yes, Mr. Colville. Yes, sir.
Get the copter fueled. Get me a double holster and a full bandolier of ammunition.
Yes, sir.
Tom, when I get back, I'll see that you rot in the deepest cell in the Gallatin Tower. I'm going out now to those hills. I'm going to bring in that uranium myself.
Two days later, Wiracek came into my office. His face was pale. His hands shook with excitement.
He's here, Mr. Tom. He's here.
Colville?
No, the Chief Potter.
The Potter? Bring him in.
Should I call the guard?
Just bring him in. Well, Potter, I was just going to the mountains to see you.
Earthman, does that bargain we made still stand?
Just a minute. First, I want to know what happened to my chief. He has not returned.
A madman came to the village of the Potters. He said you had no authority. He said he could not allow the Potters to keep the heavy metal that makes glaze like the sunset.
What happened to Colville? Tell me.
There was violence. He killed 6 good wheelmen. He was captured. I come to find whether our contract is good.
Captured. All right, Potter. The contract is good. It is bound by my word and by the word of my great chief back on Earth. But only if Colville is returned. He must be brought back.
Good. Then to seal the bargain, I have brought you the first bowl made with the new yellow glaze.
It's a beautiful vase, Potter. And now, about returning Colville.
It is done. The madman is a lucky man indeed, for his spirit dwells in the brightest glass ever to come from the Great Burn.
You mean that Colville...
Here. I return him to you. The fiery soul of the madman has given luster to an already glorious glaze. He will live forever in the shining light.
On the desk stood a yellow bowl, and the beauty of its shape was matched by the intensity of the glaze. A glorious, transparent yellow, fire of a volcano's core. Tonight, Dimension X has transcribed The Potters of Fersk, written by Jack Vance and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in the cast were Carl Weber as Michael Tom, Wendell Holmes as Colville, and Raymond Edward Johnson as the chief of the Potters. Your narrator, Norman Rose. Music by Albert Berman. Engineer, Bill Chambers. Dimension X is produced by Van Woodward and directed by Edward King. Tomorrow, hear Sam Spade. Now, it's Truth or Consequences on NBC.
Hi, I'm Mr. Mumbles, and this is Mantle Moon, continuing until dawn here on CKUW 95.9 FM Winnipeg. Lots of whatever going on. And that's just how it is. Yeah, back. We'll be right back. You're listening to Mattel Moon, coming to you from CKUW 95.9 FM Winnipeg.
National Broadcasting Company presents Lights Out, a summer revival of the famous series which many of our listeners will remember. Tonight's story, the eighth and the last in this series, is called The Signalman. Lights out. Everybody. This is the witching hour. The hour when dogs howl and evil is let loose on the sleeping world. Sit in the dark now and listen to Lights Out. Calling to a man who stood beside a railroad track at the bottom of a deep and rocky ravine. One would have thought that, considering the nature of the ground, he would have looked up to where I was standing. But instead, he turned and looked down the railroad line. I called again.
Hello, below there!
Because the terrible glare of the setting sun was in my eyes, I put my left arm across my face and waved to him with my right. He looked up and I saw in his face an expression of intense horror. He regarded me fixedly without moving. I shouted,
"Is there a path by which I can come down and speak to you?"
He continued to stare at me. Gradually, the expression of horror seemed to pass from his face, leaving it a gray, empty mask. When he spoke, his voice seemed to come from a grave.
Why do you wish to speak to me?
No reason. Just want to talk.
If you have no reason, then please go on your way.
Well, I do have a reason. Let me come down and talk to you.
He motioned with his little rolled-up flag to a narrow path about 200 yards distant, which descended the rocky wall of the ravine. I carefully made my way down it. The ravine was extremely deep and unusually precipitous. The man's post at the bottom was in as solitary and dismal a place as I'd ever seen. I could see the railroad tracks running into a dark, gloomy tunnel at one end of it. So little sunlight ever found its way to the spot that it had an earthy, deadly smell. And so much cold wind rushed through that it struck chill into me as though I'd left the mortal world. Hello, I'm afraid I'm intruding.
Well?
I'd better explain. You see, I'm a reporter for the London Times. You know the Times.
Yes, I know the Times.
Well, I'm a new man. I was assigned to do a series of stories on people who work at little-known occupations in the city. And strolling along, seeing you down here, I thought, here is a story.
And that's the reason that brought you down here?
Yes, Perhaps I'd better ask you a few questions, hadn't I? For instance, how far down are we? I've never seen anything quite like this before.
52 feet.
Is that considered deep for railroad cutting?
Deepest in the country.
52 feet, And how long is the tunnel?
3/4 mile.
I see. And that red signal light in front of the tunnel, is that part of your job? I mean, do you have to see that it stays lighted all the time?
Don't you know that it is?
Don't I know it is? Look, you've been staring at me ever since I called to you. Staring as though I were something to be afraid of. I'm just a newspaper reporter, that's all.
I thought I'd seen you before.
Seen me? But where?
There. By that signal light.
But I've never been here before. The part of London I've never visited. No, you may be sure of that.
Perhaps I may. Yes, I'm sure I may. I beg your pardon for being so unfriendly. It's just that, well, I made a mistake.
That's all right. I shouldn't have come down, I suppose. After I saw this unusual ravine in the tunnel and your job down here, I felt I had to come down and talk to you.
I think I'm glad you did. I have very little company. This is a world here different from other men's worlds.
I can believe that. May I ask, what exactly is the nature of your job? I mean, besides keeping the signal light burning and flagging the trains, what do you have to do?
Not very much. I operate the telegraph in my hut over there. Turn this iron handle now and then. That's all.
And you're down here all the time?
Yes.
Don't you ever get a chance to take a few minutes off and get up there on top? In the sunlight?
Very seldom. I can't leave the telegraph. Oh, by the way, I have a fire in my signal house. Wouldn't you like to come in and warm yourself?
Oh, indeed I would. This wind cuts right through me.
We'll hurry along. There. This will be better.
Yes.
I'll just put a little more wood on the fire. Poke it down.
How do you stand that wind? I'm about frozen.
I've been here 8 or 9 years, maybe 10. I'm used to the wind. It never changes. Here, take this chair close to the fire.
Oh, thank you. Tell me, don't you ever feel cut off from the world? Almost as though you were marooned and isolated down here?
Yes, I do. This is a world in itself, down here. It's as wide as the tunnel is and as high. Those are the boundaries of my world. For 1 hour, sometimes less, the sunlight falls into it. And at night I see the bright stars, as other men do. But that is all our two worlds hold in common.
But why did you ever take such a job?
Because I... Oh, excuse me. A message.
Certainly.
6:15, Roxborough. 10 minutes late. Received message. All's well.
Do you know, after talking to you, I feel as though I've at last met with a completely contented man.
I believe I used to be so, at one time. But now, I'm worried. Worried.
About what?
I don't know. It's difficult to explain.
Perhaps I can help you.
I've been thinking of that. I've been wondering.
Tell me.
I've got to tell someone. And yet, give me some time to think it over. Say until tomorrow night, perhaps then.
You mean you'd like me to come back?
Yes, if it wouldn't be too much trouble.
I'll be here, about the same time. But why not now? Why can't you tell me now?
I want to think it over in my mind first. I want to be sure. Meanwhile, let me light your way to the path.
Oh, yes, of course.
Don't forget your pad and pencil.
Thank you. Oh. Dark, isn't it?
Yes, be careful. Everything gets damp and slippery down here at this time of the night.
Oh. I didn't think 52 feet would make such a difference in atmosphere.
There's the path. And let me ask one favor of you.
Yes?
When you reach the top, don't call out.
Very well.
And tomorrow when you come, don't call out. Tell me, what made you cry out hello below there tonight?
I don't know. Did I cry something to that effect?
Not to that effect. Those were the very words. I know them well.
I suppose I said them because I saw you below.
With your left hand across your face and your right arm raised.
The sunset was in my eyes.
That was the only reason?
What other reason could I possibly have?
You had no feeling that the words and gesture were conveyed to you in any supernatural way?
No, of course not.
I see. Well, good night then. I'll see you tomorrow night.
Yes. Yes, tomorrow night. That night, I slept poorly. Or rather, I didn't sleep. Because the man's face was constantly before me. And there was something in the eyes of fear, a wordless crying, agony of spirit that fevered my own brain and wouldn't let me rest. All night long, I watched the face, and behind it was the sun going down in flames beyond the ravine, and a figure which I recognized as myself, one arm shading the eyes, the other waving and standing in the ravine and shouting, "Hello below there!" In the morning, my landlady awakened me. She said I'd been crying out in my sleep all night. Throughout that day, I worked with one eye on the clock, counting the hours until my appointment with the signalman. At last it came. The sun was going down again as I made my way down the path into the dank and unworldly ravine. He was waiting for me at the bottom with his white light. I didn't call to you. It's as you asked.
I'm glad you didn't. I was waiting for you. Come along. We'll go into the hut and talk. It's warm there.
Good.
I'm glad you came. At times during the day, I feared you wouldn't.
I promised you.
Yes. I've made up my mind to tell you the story.
Hmm.
The whole thing. Sit down.
Thank you.
But before I do, tell me, do you believe that I am in my right mind?
Yes. Yes, I believe that.
All right. Do you remember yesterday evening the fact that I took you for someone else?
Yes.
That's what's troubling me.
The mistake you mean?
No. There's someone else I took you for.
Who is he?
I don't know.
Does he look like me?
I don't know. I've never seen his face. You see, the left arm is across the face, always. And the right arm is waved violently this way. It's as though he were trying to signal me. For God's sake, clear the way!
Where do you see him?
I may as well start at the beginning. One moonlight night about a year ago, I was sitting here when I heard a voice cry out,
"Hello, below there!"
It was just as you called last evening. I jumped up and looked out of the door and saw this someone else standing by the red light near the tunnel, waving just as you did last night.
One arm across the face, the other waving toward you?
Yes, the voice seemed hoarse with shouting, and it cried, "Look out! Look out!" And then again, "Hello, below there, look out!" I caught up my lamp, turned it on, and ran toward this figure. "What's wrong?" I said. "What's happened?" He didn't speak. Stood just outside the blackness of the tunnel. I advanced so close upon it that I wondered at its keeping the arms across the eyes. I ran right up to it and had my hand outstretched to pull the arm away when it was gone.
Gone? Where?
I don't know. I ran on into the tunnel, 500 yards maybe. I stopped and held my lamp over my head. And all I saw were the wet stains trickling down the walls. I ran out faster than I'd run in, searched the area with my light, and then came back here and called Burnham and said the alarm had been given. Anything wrong? They answered, "All's well. Disregard alarm message."
Well, don't you suppose you could have imagined seeing
him? Yes, but you forget. I also heard him.
Yes, but listen to the wind whistling through the tunnel. It sounds almost human at times. It's possible to imagine.
Let me finish. You haven't heard the rest. Within 6 hours after the appearance, 6 hours, mind you, the 2:40 train came through the tunnel, slowed down and stopped. The engineer signaled me and I hurried up to the cab. What's the matter?
Don't know. One of the conductors signaled for a stop. Everything all right here?
Yes, just got the all clear signal.
Here comes the conductor now. Hello. What's wrong back there? What did you pull the cord for?
An accident. Where's the signalman around here?
That's me.
You have a shack nearby.
Right over there.
What happened, man?
A woman was killed.
Killed?
No. She was passing between the coaches. I suppose she slipped, was caught between the couplings.
But no.
Nobody seems to know, sir. She was crushed horribly. On account of the other passengers, we've got to get the body off.
Have them take her to my shack.
You
have them take her. from the shock when one morning, just as day was breaking, I looked toward the red signal light and saw him again.
Did he cry out this time?
No. He was silent.
Did he wave his arm?
Yes, the right one. The left, as usual, was across his eyes. He seemed to be pointing down into the tunnel. He leaned against the shaft of the light like a... like a statue over a grave.
Did anything happen? Any accident, anything?
Not immediately. He was there. I saw him. Then he was gone. I waited for the hours to pass. When 6 hours went by and nothing had happened, I began to feel relieved. By nightfall, I had almost forgotten it and was able to read quite calmly as the hours passed. I was sitting here reading, the door open, when I heard a train. It was the midnight express from Brighton. I recognized the whistle. I got out my flag, stepped to the door. I could hear them for miles beyond the tunnel entrance. I listened to the wheels filling the night with their driving, pounding rhythmic beat. And I thought of the people on the train, the tired, worn-out picnickers and weekenders returning from Brighton. It made me feel responsible for them, as though I were their guardian and keeper. I listened to the rhythmic beat of the wheels. The train was nearing the tunnel mouth. I listened to the regular, powerful beat of them, and then suddenly I realized that they weren't regular. There was no rhythm, only the terrible raging cry of a machine that has suddenly broken through its own power and is heading for destruction. It was the worst wreck on the line. They brought the dead and dying in here. They laid them at the place where he stood waving to me that very morning.
And this was the second accident after you'd seen him?
Yes. And the thing that is worrying me now, it came back again a week ago. Oh. Ever since, he's been there now and again by fits and starts.
Standing by the light?
Yes.
What does he seem to do?
The left arm is over the face. The right arm is waving. He seems to be trying to say, for God's sake, clear the way.
Can't believe it.
I have no peace or rest from it. It calls to me for many minutes together in a frightful manner. Below there, look out, look out. It stands waving to me.
Well, have you seen it tonight?
No. Not yet.
Well, will you come to the door with me and look for it now?
Yes. Yes, I will.
Do you see it?
No. It's not there.
Then let's go back.
It wasn't there now, but it may be there a moment from now. What troubles me is, what does this specter mean? What is the danger? Where is the danger? There is danger overhanging somewhere on this line. Some dreadful calamity is about to happen. It's not to be doubted this third time after what has gone before. But what can I do?
Nothing that I can see.
If I telegraph danger, I can give no reason for it. I should get into trouble and do no one any good. They would think I was mad. I would wire danger, take care. And they would answer, what danger, where? And I would have to wire back, don't know, but for God's sake, take care. And they would, of course, discharge me. What else could they do?
Yes, I see.
When it first stood under that light, why didn't it tell me? She is going to die. Let them keep her at home. When it came the second time, why didn't it tell me how the accident could have been averted? It came on those occasions only to show me that its warnings were true. Why doesn't it warn me plainly now? Why doesn't it tell me what is going to happen so that I can change it?
Listen, there's nothing you can do. Or rather, you're doing the only thing that any sane, normal person would do, and that's nothing. The important thing is to keep your balance now.
Don't get worked up to the point that if you need to act later, you won't be able to.
Yes. You're right. Of course you're right.
You're doing your job as well as it's humanly possible to do. You're not responsible for the future. You're responsible only for the present. What happens at this switch now? You've got to look at it that way.
I know. I know. Only I can't forget that something is going to happen.
I don't doubt that. But if you keep your eyes open at all times, you may be able to prevent it.
I pray to God I may.
It's easy to say, but try not to think about it too much.
I try. But it's the responsibility that crushes me. Because of this specter, because of this knowledge of things that will happen along this line, I am responsible for every child, every mother, every person that rides upon it. I know that something is going to happen. I ought to warn them, but I don't know how to warn them when they die. If they die, their deaths are on my shoulders.
Look, would you like me to spend the rest of the night with you? Perhaps it would help keep your mind off things.
No, thank you. I'll be all right. You don't know what a blessing it's been just to be able to tell you the whole story.
Would you like me to come back tomorrow night?
Would you mind?
No.
And when you write your story about me, about this job...
Yes?
If you could tell the whole story, everything I've told you, it would help lift this awful responsibility from my shoulders. People would know, then. They might think me mad, but they would know. And the weight would be from my spirit.
Yes, I'll write that story tomorrow. Everything. You needn't be afraid that I'll skip anything. I'll bring it along with me and show it to you before I turn it in.
It would mean so much.
Yes. Now, I think it's best that I go.
Good night, then. And you will come back tomorrow?
Yes.
Can you find the path?
Easily. I'm beginning to know it by heart now. Good night. I went to bed immediately after returning to my lodgings. If I had slept unsoundly the night before, I slept little, if any, this night. There were the same dreams, the man's face, his eyes with their deep inner secret and pain, and in the background the sun going down over the ravine, and the figure, no longer my own, with one arm across the eyes and the other waving toward me, crying in a low moan, "Clear the way! Clear the way!" In the morning, when I came to work, I felt tired, almost feverish. I could hardly wait until sundown when I would again visit the signalman. I wanted to show him the story as I'd written it. At last, the hands of the clock pointed to 6:30, and I left the office on my way to the ravine. About half an hour later, I arrived at the top of the cutting. I glanced down, and there, close at the mouth of the tunnel, I saw a man, his left arm across his eyes, passionately waving his right arm. The nameless horror that oppressed me passed in a moment, for I saw that this man was a man indeed, and that there was a little group of other men standing at a short distance to whom he seemed to be rehearsing the gesture he made. With an irresistible sense that something was wrong, with a self-reproachful fear that fatal mischief had come of my leaving the man there alone in his state of mind the night before, I descended the rocky path with all the speed I could make and ran up to the crowd. What's the matter here?
Signalman killed.
When?
Just a little while ago.
Not the man belonging to this post?
Aye.
Not the man I know.
You will recognize him, sir, if you are a friend to him. The body is over here. There. You see?
Oh.
How did it happen? He was cut down by the engine, sir. Just as he was lighting that red lamp. No man on the line knew his work better. But somehow he wasn't clear of the outer rail. He had the lamp in his hand ready to light it as the engine came out of the tunnel. His back was toward it and she caught him down. Ah, here's the engineer now. Tom, show him how it happened.
Yes, how did it happen?
I'm a reporter from the Times.
Well, sir, coming around the curve in the tunnel, I saw him at the end.
There was no time to check the speed, but I always knew him to be very careful. Only this time, he didn't seem to pay any attention to the whistle. I finally shut it off when we were running down on him and called out to him.
What did you say?
I shouted, "Hello, below there! For God's sake, clear the way!"
No.
Yes, sir. That I shouted. Oh, it was a terrible thing, sir. I never left off calling to him. Finally, I put my left arm across the eyes so that I wouldn't have to see. And I waved this arm to the last. But it was no use, sir. No use. No use.
I walked away. I was trembling so that it took all my efforts to climb the rocky path to the top of the ravine. I knew the sun was going down in flames behind me, but I dared not look. I hurried back to my desk at the office and began writing the tragic end to the story.
Sir?
Yes, boy?
Is your copy ready, sir?
In just a moment.
Please hurry, sir. Piper goes to press in a half hour.
I'll have it ready. Come back in a few minutes.
All right, sir.
This, then, is the story as it was told to me and as I saw it. I make no judgment of it. No deductions. It happened. I know it happened. That is all. Except I bear with me the memory of a humble man, lonely and isolated from this world of ours, one who bore the responsibility for his fellow men so strongly on his conscience that he died from it. For I am convinced that that alone is what brought him to this end, not the train, which was merely an instrument of fate. Signed, Charles Dickens.
All right. You can turn them on now.
You have just heard the eighth and the last in the summer series of Lights Out. Tonight's story, Charles Dickens, the Signalman, was adapted for radio by Frederick J. Lipp. Starring in the role of Charles Dickens was Nelson Armstead. The Signalman was played by Herb Butterfield. Others in the cast included Boris Apland, Nathan Davis, and Jess Pugh. And now it's time to turn the lights out for the summer. We've enjoyed bringing you these shows, and if we've managed to send a few chills up and down your spine, well, that's what we set out to do. Beginning next week at this time, be sure to hear the new Judy Canova show, which returns to the air. You'll have the time of your life, so be sure to listen. Lights Out was produced and directed by Albert Cruz. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
You're listening to Matt to the Moon, coming to you from CKUW 95.9 FM Winnipeg.
National Broadcasting Company invites you by transcription to join The Chase. There is always the hunter and the hunted, the pursuer and the pursued. It may be the voice of authority or a race with death and destruction, the most relentless of the hunters. There are times when laughter is heard as counterpoint and moments when sheer terror is the theme. Always there is the chase.
Welcome to Monte Carlo, sir. Are you looking for a guide? I know the Principality well, sir, and for a small gratuity, I'll be happy to put my services at your disposal. The Prince's Palace? Why, of course, sir, a tour could be arranged. But visiting hours are from 2 to 5, and we have 30 minutes or so to wait. So let's sit here at this small cafe, with the warm sun in our faces and the good spring breeze in our lungs, and watch the passing parade. You ask if I'm British, sir? I know, although I was educated at Eton and Oxford. You see, actually, I'm a citizen of... Well, the name doesn't matter. Suffice to say, the kingdom is a small one. Did I say kingdom? Well, it's not a monarchy anymore. It was acquired, so to speak, by certain foreign interests some time ago, during the reign of His Royal Highness King Donald III.
Your Majesty. Sire.
Huh?
It's time to awake.
Oh. It's you, Jerrick. You interrupted a fascinating dream.
I beg your pardon, sir.
A most magnificent dream, Jerrick. With ballet dancers.
My abject apologies, sire.
Think nothing of it, Jerrick, my friend. What day is it?
Tuesday.
The time?
11:12, your Majesty.
And the weather?
Cloudy, I'm afraid.
Too bad. What shall I wear today, Jerrick?
I was thinking of the grey pinstripe, sire. The suit you acquired on your visit to the United States.
An excellent suggestion. And the accessories?
A blue figured tie would be attractive. It goes well with grey.
Jerrick, you're a genius.
Thank you, sire.
You're absolutely the most brilliant valet a king could have. And your English is always superb. I wish all my subjects were as quick with language as you are.
When you issued orders that English was to be the language spoken in the palace after your return from Oxford, your Majesty, I hastened to please you as best I could.
And you've done well, Jerrick. Our own language is so archaic, so difficult to learn. We need a change in language. And I've always favored English over French.
Sire, I must remind you
and
that
I think
you have
even newer innovations for my people, Jerrick. Our educational processes are out of date. They must learn more about economics, for instance, and the principles of a democratic way of life.
Of course, Your Majesty. But please, sire, I must remind you that you have an appointment.
And when they've learned those principles well, Jerrick... Oh, did you say something about an appointment?
General Cranick will be here at noon, sire.
Oh, Cranick.
He telephoned to the palace this morning, sire. He said it was most urgent.
Urgent, eh? What does he want? Another decoration? He's got so many on his chest right now, he can hardly walk.
The general told me to tell you, sire, that his visit is in the nature of an emergency, and he demanded that you be ready to receive him on time.
He demanded, did you say?
He did, sire.
Rather cheeky of him, wasn't it?
It was, sire.
He'd better be careful.
Your Majesty, may I suggest that you hurry? There isn't much time.
All right, Jake, let's get on with it. We'll see why Cranick is so impatient. General Cranick, my dear sir, was commander-in-chief of the army. But how he reached that eminent position, heaven only knows. It was my father, Dano II, who gave him his commission as a colonel. And by one intrigue or another, Cranick managed to push himself to the top. He was ambitious, I knew that very well. But I never realized how high a goal this opportunist had set for himself until I granted his interview in the throne room that day at noon. Come in, General. Come in.
Desto pavisce, mosc me.
If you don't mind, I prefer to speak English inside the palace, General. It's part of my campaign to educate the people.
As you wish, Your Majesty. Although I am afraid that campaign will be a short-lived one.
What do you mean?
The situation is actually very grave.
What situation?
Yours, Dano.
What did you call me?
Your name is Dano, is it not?
Only royalty is permitted to address me so familiarly, General. You know that very well.
Oh, let us stop behaving as if we were comic opera figures, Dano. The show is over.
What are you getting at, Cranick? Speak up.
Very well. At midnight, last night, while the royal head was asleep on the royal pillow, I surrendered the royal army to our friends behind the Iron Curtain.
You what?
There was nothing left to do. Sire, we are completely surrounded, as you know. If they attacked, we would not have a chance. Besides, they are our friends. They merely want to help us re-educate the people.
Re-educate them? Enslave them, you mean? No. No, Krennic, you can't do this. I still outrank you here, and I will countermand the order.
It is too late. Our soldiers have already surrendered their arms. Even now, the opposition is marching through the capital. And the officer's corps is with me.
You must have planned long in advance, Krennic.
It took time.
And your fee for turning traitor to your country?
I don't like that word.
It's true, isn't it?
What about you? Where have you been all the while? You might have stopped me, but you were too interested in traveling about the world.
Yes, that may be so. I've been away much more than I've been at home. But I wanted to learn new methods, modern ideas, better ways to improve the lot of our people.
I assure you that I will do my utmost to carry on that noble idea, Your Majesty.
You?
Oh, I neglected to mention that our new friends and allies have appointed me Prime Minister.
I see.
It was inevitable.
Very well. It was inevitable, as you say. How much time do I have to leave?
But you are not leaving, Darno.
I'm not.
It doesn't serve our interests to have you wandering about in the West. It might create sympathy for you and annoyance for us in many ways.
Then what do you propose I do? Are you going to have me assassinated?
That, too, would cause an unfavorable reaction. No, we have decided on another course. Suicide.
Suicide?
Yes.
You must be insane to propose a preposterous idea like that.
But I'm sure you will agree to carry out our suggestion.
I'll agree to nothing of the kind. Oh, no, Krennic. If you're going to kill me, you'll have to do it yourself. And face a revolution. I happen to be popular with my people.
Very popular, Dano. That is why suicide is such an excellent method. They will think of you as having gone insane, and you will soon be forgotten. You have your choice, Dano. Either you do as we say, or you face an uncomfortable week or two with several very persuasive people.
You mean you'd try torture?
An ugly word and a bit of an understatement, too.
I don't doubt it.
Well?
You leave me very little choice.
You are lucky. It was only because of me that you were granted so easy a way out.
I owe you my unending gratitude.
And we are in agreement. You will remove yourself, as it were, with your own hand.
When?
Now.
He unstrapped his gun holster and took out his service revolver. With a polite bow, he handed the gun to me. For a moment, as I felt the barrel, I had an impulse. An impulse to pull the trigger and blast his grinning face. But he seemed to read my thoughts, for his smile didn't falter as he said,
I wouldn't if I were you.
No?
No. First of all, it would do you no good. There are many others who can take my place. And secondly, it would give our new government the opportunity to put you on trial for the murder of your most trusted officer. Then they would be able to hang you with the sympathy of the people.
You have it all worked out, I see.
To the last detail.
May I have 5 minutes?
Why prolong the agony?
You might at least leave a man alone for a short time before he's about to die.
Very well. Incidentally, there is only one bullet in that gun chamber. Make certain your aim is good. I would shoot through the roof of the mouth. It is neater.
Thank you for the suggestion.
You have 5 minutes. No more. Lock the door to this throne room before you fire the shot.
Lock the door? Why?
The natural impulse of the suicide to avoid interruption. When I hear the report of the gun, I will try to enter the room. But the door will be barred. I will then call an emergency squad and force my way in.
Your thoroughness is overwhelming, Krennic.
It has always been one of my greatest assets. Well, I'll bid you goodbye now. Shake your hand for luck.
I'd sooner shake hands with a ghoul.
Suit yourself.
But let me hear that revolver speak in 5 minutes, Dono. No longer.
He stepped out of the door, and I bolted it, then moved over to the center of the room. I glanced at the gun in my hand and felt a slow wave of revulsion creep over my skin. The situation was ridiculous. I was king, head of the royal family. But what could I do? If I refused, I knew what lay ahead for me. But if I escaped... The minutes were slipping by, and there was only one way of leaving the room. But I could hear Krennic outside with three or four henchmen. But perhaps I had one chance. A slim one, but worth taking. I waited until my 5 minutes were almost up. Then raised my gun and fired once. At the ceiling. Then I heard them try the door. A moment later, I heard them leave to look for the palace guard. And when I opened the door, I saw the corridor was clear.
Hurry, you fool. Break the door down. I distinctly heard the shot, and I think the senior killed himself. Faster, faster. Everyone remain outside. I'll investigate myself. But he is. He is!
Getting out of a palace is a simple matter for a man who's lived there all his life, who knows every nook in the dark. But the palace was one thing. Getting out of my own country was another. My face and head, moustached and heavily shocked with long hair, adorned every postage stamp. I had been photographed 1,000 times and could be recognized by any one of my subjects. Innocently, they would create a scene on seeing me that would soon have me back in Krennic's hands. So I had to disguise myself. But first, there was the problem of money. I had none on my person when I left the palace. But fortunately, I did have a large star sapphire ring. And I decided to chance selling it at a pawnbroker's. I slipped on a pair of sunglasses, put my coat collar high and my hat very low, and crossed my fingers.
I'm sorry, I don't speak your language. I'm a British tourist.
I speak English, sir. It is our second language.
Oh, good.
What can I do for you?
I want to pawn a ring.
May I see it, please?
Yes, here.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a short-term loan I want. I'm not asking for the maximum.
I can give you 1,000 gestas.
1,000 gestas, that's about £200 in English money. It's worth a great deal more.
I'm sorry, that is all I can offer.
I'll take it.
Fill out this slip, please. I bring the morning.
Very well, but hurry, please.
As I leaned over the counter to fill out the slip, my eyes were bothered by the sunglasses and I couldn't see very clearly. So, unthinkingly, I slipped them off and bent my head over the receipt he'd given me. A minute later, he returned, the money in his hand. I raised my head and he looked at me squarely.
Your Majesty.
What are you talking about?
The king. The king in my shop.
Give me that money.
It is your Majesty.
Once out of the shop, I bought a pair of scissors and some shaving equipment. Then I stepped into a public washroom at the railway station, waited until it emptied, and went to work on my hair and moustache. 20 minutes later, I'd made a fair attempt at disguising myself. I could walk the streets now if I was careful, but that was a far cry from walking across the frontier. I'd heard about a small cafe, a coffee shop where black market goods were traded, and a man could get almost anything he needed at a price. I found the place, sat down over a cup of coffee, and waited.
Deket, Basna, Likun?
Sorry, I don't speak the language. I'm a tourist.
I asked if you wanted to change some money at a good rate. You have English pounds?
No, just gestas.
Oh.
But I am in the market for something.
Yes? What?
A passport.
Passport?
I lost mine, you see.
Then why not go to the British consulate for another?
I can't.
Oh, are they looking for you?
Yes.
Why?
What difference does it make? I need a passport. If you have none to sell, stop wasting my time.
Perhaps I can get you one if you can pay for it.
How much do you want?
How much have you got?
600 gestas.
For a forged passport?
900. That's all I've got.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. For a passport, I can get...
What are you looking at?
I may be able to help you out at that.
Really?
I'll need the photographs.
I'll get them for you.
Good. Then meet me at this address here on the card upstairs. Room number 12.
When?
In 1 hour.
All right. I'll be there.
By the way, what did you say your name was?
I didn't say. But it's Welbley. Claude Welbley.
Welbley? All right, Mr. Welbley. In 1 hour.
But something in his voice gave me pause, and I decided to approach this rendezvous with caution. The address was in a poorer section of town, a decrepit house that advertised furnished rooms. I arrived 20 minutes ahead of time. But instead of going upstairs, I hid behind the staircase. 15 minutes later, my cafe friend arrived with a companion.
He should be upstairs, General. Room number 12.
Are you sure it was the king you spoke to?
Oh, absolutely. He shaved his mustache and cut his hair very short. But I saw the royal crest on his tie clasp.
You were wise to contact me directly.
I heard from certain sources that you have been looking for a high personage, General Kranich, and I knew it would pay me well to prove my loyalty to you.
It will also pay you well to keep your mouth shut. The room is number 12, you say?
Yes.
Wait here.
Kranich drew another gun and slowly mounted the steps. My informer watched him go, his back towards my hiding place. As I heard a door open on the second story, I stepped out quickly, caught the informer behind his ear with the empty revolver I still retained.
What's going on down there? Stop! Stop, you hear?
As I raced out the door, I heard Kranich screaming behind me. There was no time now to lose myself in the streets. I had to get out of range of Kranich's bullets in a hurry. I rushed into the first building I reached just as his last shot whistled through the hem of my trench coat. It was a large hotel patronized by tourists. And as I quickly mounted the stairs like a hunted animal, I wondered if Kranich had seen me enter. I had to find protection. And so when I thought I heard commotion behind me as I reached the third floor landing, I opened the first room door I came to and stepped inside.
Well!
I beg your pardon, miss.
You might have knocked before coming in. Well, at any rate, you're here at last, and that's something.
Is it?
What's the matter with you? You're panting like a racehorse. You are the guide the travel bureau sent, aren't you?
Yes, of course. I'm the guide, Miss...
Carpenter, Eloise Carpenter. All right, let's get started.
Started?
I want to see the city.
Oh, the city.
What on earth is wrong with you, anyway?
Nothing. I'd be glad to show you around, Miss Carpenter.
Are you British?
Why do you ask?
Your accent. I thought they'd send a native guide.
I know the city as well as any native does, Miss Carpenter.
What's your name?
Welbley. But I'm usually referred to by my nickname, Danny.
Danny. That's more American than British.
You're American, aren't you?
100%.
I'm rather fond of Americans. I mean, they're so easygoing and friendly. The American ambassador taught me your game of gin rummy when he...
You played cards with the American ambassador?
Well, you see, I was his guide for today.
Oh.
Where do you want to go first?
The Royal Palace, of course.
The Royal Palace?
Yes, I'm dying to see what it looks like. Perhaps I'll even get a glimpse of the king.
I don't think so.
What?
I mean, the palace is closed. They don't allow visitors at this time of night.
Oh, I have a special pass issued by General Krennic. My father got it for me. He's president of Interocean Airlines. How far is the palace from here?
Oh, 5 miles. It's much too far to go.
Now, look here. My plane leaves at midnight, and I'm going to have a look at the king if it's the last thing I do. Have you ever seen the king?
Many times.
I've heard he's very handsome. Is that true?
Well, he's fairly attractive, I'd say, and quite susceptible to feminine charms.
Oh, gee, I'd give anything to meet him.
Perhaps before you leave, I can arrange that, too. It had suddenly occurred to me that with Krennic on the streets searching for me, I'd be fairly safe going through the palace in the role of a guide with this American girl. And if I could manage to get into my own private apartments, I could make out a certificate of diplomatic immunity for myself that would get me across the frontier. But in order to do it, I needed the royal seal, which was on my desk. So I decided to take the risk. Half an hour later, we were inside the palace. And as I guided her through the wide corridors that led to my rooms, I kept a sharp eye open for surprises. Follow me, Miss Carpenter.
You certainly know your way around here, Danny.
I've been here before.
Oh, wait.
What is it?
This painting on the wall. Who is he?
Well, that's the king.
Oh.
Oh, what?
He's not as good looking as I thought he'd be.
The artist didn't do him justice.
Oh. Is he married?
No, thank goodness.
What?
He's never met the right girl.
Oh, choosy, isn't he?
Come along, Miss Carpenter.
What's the big hurry? I've got 2 hours before my plane leaves. My luggage is at the airport.
It's getting late. Even though your special pass got us in here very easily, we'll be asked to leave any moment now. Come this way.
You have a key to that door?
It's part of the guide's equipment. Inside.
Why so cautious? You're walking as though you're afraid of being... Why are you going into that desk drawer?
I'm looking for something. I'll be busy for a minute or two. Make yourself at home.
Whose apartment is this?
The king's.
His private room?
Yes.
Look,